Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 159 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, poet and fiction writer Lorna Thorpe speaks with Jeff Hattersley about wild youth and being a late starter in everything, becoming a poet by accident, being dead for 6 minutes, and her American and musical influences.
Lorna Thorpe was born in Brighton in 1955. Before turning her hand to writing, she worked as a barmaid, tour operator, and social worker. Having studied fiction on the MA in creative writing at the University of East Anglia as a mature student, Lorna enjoyed some success as a short story writer before becoming a poet, she says, by accident. Her first collection, Dancing to Motown, was published in 2005 and was a Poetry Book Society pamphlet choice, and she has gone on to publish two subsequent collections, A Ghost in My House and Sweet Torture of Breathing. She's now once again concentrating on writing fiction. Hello, Lorna. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Jeff. Good to meet you.
Now, you sort of appeared on the poetry scene out of nowhere back in 2005 with a pamphlet, Dancing to Motown.
That's right.
Which caused quite a splash, you know. It got a Poetry Book Society choice, I believe, yeah?
It did, yeah.
And you were quite old at the time, perhaps around about 50, which is relevant.
Yes, it's true. I call myself, I'm a late starter. I'm a late starter in everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read somewhere that you said you became a poet by accident. Well, how did you come to write the poems in Dancing to Motown all of a sudden? And
what happened was I was actually working on a novel, and I was completely stuck with it. I started to see it almost like Kurtz in the Jungle. It was just this big monstrous thing, and I couldn't get moving on it at all. And I'm not even sure I believe in writer's block, but I literally couldn't work on that novel. So I decided to... No, what happened was I saw a poetry workshop with Brendan Cleary advertised. And I thought, I'll go and take that. Sort of a coming at it from another angle. So I'd done lots of fiction writing workshops. And so I took this workshop with Brendan, and he at some point said to me, well, you should be writing poetry. I have to say, I didn't take that workshop with any intention of writing poetry. I had never, ever thought of myself as a poet. And he said, yes, you should write poetry. You're a poet. And I sort of thought, oh, yeah. But then what happened was there was an organisation in Brighton at the time called The South that put on regular poetry readings. And I was asked to go and read, not as the main person by any means, but just kind of as a support act, if you like. And I think at that time I had 6 poems to my name. That was it. Yeah. I read all 6 of them. And actually, the other thing about it was that these events that the South put on were usually very, very well attended. It was packed, not for me, I might add, but because I remember Catherine Smith was reading then, but I can't remember who else. And at the end of that, John Davies, who ran Pig Hog Press, a local publisher's, came up to me and said that he wanted to produce a pamphlet of mine. I mean, it was one of those real sort of magical, you know, dream come true things. I couldn't. And he wanted it done, oh, I don't know, in quite a short space of time. So in this short space of time, I had to go from 6 poems to, I think it was 20 or 21 poems. And that's how it came about, really.
Right, well, it's remarkable that they're all so good then, isn't it?
Well, some of that I think is, I mean, definitely thanks to Brendan, who's a very good teacher, actually.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of those poems, I mean, if I'm actually honest, I hadn't even read that much poetry by that stage. So that it's very intuitive, I think, my writing.
Yeah.
It's certainly in that first pamphlet and the first collection.
Yeah, most of the poems from that ended up in the first full-length collection.
They did, yes, yeah.
Ghost in My House.
Ghost in My House.
Where did you get the title for that?
Well, I've always been a big fan of Motown. And the first book was obviously called Dancing to Motown. That's the title of one of the poems. The Ghost in My House, I had a poem called A Ghost in My House.
Yeah.
Actually, there's two things here. Partly, I wanted to continue that Motown theme in a way, but mainly it seemed that it represented something of what the collection was about.
Yeah.
And I didn't set out with an idea of that's what the collection was going to be about, because I just wrote some poems, basically. And then when I had a certain number of poems, I thought, kind of, I suppose I'm getting close to a collection. And when I looked at them, I saw that they did seem to fit together. And that this idea of the ghost in the house, which is partly, well, a lot of it is my father, actually, but also sort of memories. There are poems about childhood and coming of age poems in there, and that, and those memories were also the ghost in the house.
Right, so A Ghost in My House, that's a Motown title.
Yeah, it's a song by Ardeen Taylor. And it came out in the 60s, but it wasn't actually a hit until something like 1974.
Ah, right, no, I didn't know that. Well, you were born in Brighton. I read that you were born and brought up in a pub, and that I read somewhere you always loved the smell of pubs since you were a child.
Absolutely true. So both of my sets of grandparents ran pubs at some point in their lives. And my maternal grandparents ran a pub called the Edinburgh in Brighton. And my parents were living with them before they had found somewhere to live. And the Sussex Maternity Hospital was literally across the road. And apparently my dad could stand on the toilet seat and look out of the window and wave goodnight to my mother. So my first journey, and I think there is something significant in this, my first journey was crossing the road to the pub. So, I mean, in terms of my background, my father's family in particular, who were very poor when they were younger, are tremendous boozers. And my mother didn't really particularly drink, but my grandmother certainly liked to drink, and I lived with her for a little while when I was kicked out of home. So yeah, booze really was quite a big current through my life, I should say.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were kicked out of home and went to live with your grandmother, you say?
Yeah.
I noticed that a lot of the poems in the first book sort of refer to a difficult relationship with your father. You know, he seemed to get physically abusive to you.
He did, yeah.
Well, you never know how true the poems are, how autobiographical they are, you know, but...
No, because there's always that thing, isn't there, that you actually... things don't always happen as you've written them in the poem, because you're striking at some other sort of truth. And in the and after a while, it's your sort of fidelity becomes to the poem rather than the material, that the subject that you started out with, I think. But yes, there is a poem about him beating me up, basically, which is what happened. And I think what happened was that he couldn't really deal with me growing up. It wasn't just that. He was he was temperamental, and I think had tremendous emotions that he had difficulty expressing. And, yeah, he and I had a very difficult, you know, as soon as I started, you know, transitioning into womanhood, if you like, or certainly the teenage years, that became very difficult. And I was quite rebellious. I didn't, you know, my mother would always say, why can't you just keep quiet? Why don't you say, you know, but I couldn't really. So that was problematic, yeah.
Right, yeah, I think I know the poem you refer to when you say he beat you up, he sort of drags you downstairs.
Yes.
And it ends up with him calling you nothing but trouble, and you were sitting in your room later and thinking, I'll show you trouble.
Yes, exactly. That sort of sums it up.
Is yourself then, yeah?
Yeah, it is. Yes, that's, yeah. So it was after that I went to live with my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, for a while. I mean, it precipitated something that I'd wanted to happen anyway, because I left school when I was 16, largely because I wanted to carry on with my education, although I didn't really know what I wanted to do at that time. But what I wanted more than anything was to leave home. And to leave home, I needed to be earning money. So I went, you know, straight into work, basically. Stayed with my grandmother for a while and then, you know, ventured into the bedsit world of the 1970s.
And, yeah, I read that you had quite a wild time in your 20s too, you know.
Yeah, I had rather an extended adolescence, to be honest. Yeah.
I did as well, yes. I think mine's still going on.
Yeah, I really didn't want to grow up particularly, and I didn't. And I didn't have children, I think, so I didn't have that responsibility of kids. And a lot of my friends didn't either. And, you know, it was sex and drugs and rock and roll, really, and quite hedonistic. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the 70s are an odd time, aren't they? Because they're always talked about as a rather grim time. Yeah. But I had a great time, actually. And music, of course, discovering music, because music has been, I think, as much an influence on me as anything else.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm. It comes through in your poetry, that, you know, and to music. I often find that with poets, you know, well, writers in general, I think, and comedians too, for some reason, are very much into music.
I think particularly with poets, well, for me anyway, it's the rhythm of them. I mean, it's lyrics. I love a great lyricist, as you know, but it's also that just, you know, the rhythm for me.
So you wrote a lot of short stories before you wrote poetry. And have you written any more? I mean, are you just concentrating fully on the novel? There's no ideas for short stories, but
no. I started out writing short stories. So because I came to all sorts of writing late, because you said earlier that I sort of appeared at the age of 50, which is true.
As a poet, I meant.
As a poet, but as a writer, I didn't start writing until my 40s. I'd dabbled, you know, at times of great distress, I'd turned my hand to a bit of writing, but I'd never really taken it seriously until my 40s, when I took a creative writing course at Sussex University. And it was, I was writing short stories initially.
So at some point between the pamphlet and the collection, you had a cardiac arrest, I read.
Yeah, it was just a few months after the pamphlet was launched.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a lot of poems in that collection about it in the third part of the book. The book's in three sections. Also, they sort of overlap into the start of the second collection, you know.
I think, clearly, the death was clearly preoccupying me at the time. I mean, my heart stopped for 6 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was really lucky because I lived within sort of 2-minute drive of the A&E, basically. So that's the only reason I'm here today. Yeah. So the idea of death was clearly preoccupying me. And in the first collection, in the third part of the book, it's more dealing with the actual sort of event itself. Whereas in the second collection, I think I'm looking more at, you know, the circumstances around it and a sort of what I kind of call an inner death as well as this actual sort of potential death, yeah.
Yeah, in the second book, there are a lot of poems in the third section which seem to be about denying the death, really, you know, like that you're still intent on living life to the full. There are poems about love and sex and appreciating food and drink and so on.
Yes, I sort of see that as the, well, I mean, at the time, again, that wasn't my intention. It's just that's what I found myself writing. And I suppose they are like the coming back to life poems, if you like. Yes, and the enjoy life. Yes, there are, food and drink and sex and so on, yeah.
Yeah, I know you say you weren't that well read in poetry before you started writing it. Sort of the influences I picked up seem to be more American than English, definitely. You know, like a bit of Frank O'Hara's Wonder at Everyday Life, Sharon Olds' Honesty and Directness.
I've always gravitated towards American writers, whether that's in fiction or in poetry. So when I sort of started, you know, I started reading a lot more poetry. And certainly Sharon Holds, who I really like, for her tack on the subject matter.
Yeah.
And Frank O'Hara, for that, did that kind of thing. And also the rhythm of the poems, because I really love the rhythm of his poems, and there's a sort of little homage to Frank O'Hara in The Day Jacko Died.
Yeah, really interested in the poems in the middle section as well, where you talk about a lot of people who, well, died young or before the time, you might say, like the Rosenbergs and Billie Holiday. Particularly like the Janis Joplin and John Lennon poems.
Yeah, that section came about. I had written the Rosenberg, Ethel Rosenberg poem, I think, before I really started writing. And it was one of those poems that was an entirely chance thing. I had no intention of writing about Ethel Rosenberg. I'd actually been trying to write a poem, you know, sometimes force a poem, basically, that wasn't going anywhere, about an electric storm. And I was doing some Googling on, could I find any weather things that would be interesting? And I came across this phrase, riding the lightning, which is slang for being electrocuted. Of course, I got interested in that. And then I came across this picture of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. And I'd heard of them. But what was extraordinary was that they were kissing one another, and they looked as if they were going to devour each other. It was such an extraordinary picture, and that was what had sort of set me off on that poem. Then I wrote the one about Michael Jackson, because I wrote it on the day that it actually happened.
Right.
And I sort of thought, oh, I could, you know, here's something that would be quite interesting to explore a bit. The John Lennon one was one of those poems that was extraordinarily difficult to write. I don't really know why. I did loads of research. I couldn't find my way into it. And I realised that I'd been working on it for quite a long time. And I went out of the house one day, and obviously the subject or the poem, something had really touched me, because there was a busker singing Imagine in the street, and I had to go home because I was just going to burst into tears. So it's a really sort of... And it surprised me. I didn't expect to have, you know, that I'd had such a strong connection to it.
You were a Lennon fan, though, obviously.
Yeah, I was, yeah.
As was everybody, more or less, I guess.
Yeah, but it's one of those you can remember where you were the day you heard Lennon died.
So there have not been any poems since then, which was 2011, none that I've seen, really. And are you working towards a third collection?
No, I'm not. I have written poems, and I've had a couple in magazines and so on.
Yeah.
And I think what happened in 2011 was that we moved down to Cornwall. And I think I'd had a rather romantic idea that, you know, I'd be inspired by this change of location. And we were living in the countryside there in Menabilly. But of course, I'm definitely not a nature poet, and I'm not a rural poet. I think my poetry is probably more urban than anything else. I suppose I tried to write nature poems, and they were just awful, awful. And then the other thing that happened, a load of life events just got in the way. I mean, the whole thing of moving, I think, is probably quite stressful anyway. And then my husband fell off a cliff and broke his leg, and we were airlifted off the beach, and we had to move out of our house for 3 months because the whole front of it had to be taken off, and my mother got dementia and had to go into a care home. So life kind of took over at that point, really. And sort of in between, I was trying to write poems. But whereas before, I had never... Poems for me happen. You know, there's a... I don't know, something snags. It's an idea or some words or an image or something, and it feels like this thing needs to be written. I've got to have that thing going on. My circumstances had changed quite a lot. I think all of the poems in the previous collection had been written in a particular set of circumstances. It was quite a difficult time of my life, and everything had changed. And also I felt I didn't really necessarily want to write about myself, or certainly myself in the way I'd been writing about myself. So I had ideas about... And I'm putting that in inverted commas because I had ideas about what I wanted to write about. Total mistake. Don't give me an idea and ask me to write a poem about it. Because what happens is they were contrived, they were forced, they were dead at heart, they were dead. You know, the words were there, but nothing else was, basically. So that's what's really happened with the poetry. And on top of that, I mean, I started out as a fiction writer. And I always wanted to write a novel, and I started writing a novel. I got the first draft of it now, so I'm now working on the second draft. And that's taken, that really takes up so much headspace that it's incredibly difficult to think about writing or even thinking about anything else, to be honest.
Yeah, so is it sort of a semi-autobiographical novel or is it
about... No, not at all. I've got, you know, a number of unpublished novels or started and not finished novels, which were largely autobiographical. This is actually historical. It's based on a real person, a woman called Annie Miller, who was a model for Pre-Raphaelite artist William Holman Hunt. And it's a kind of Pygmalion story. She comes from the slums of Chelsea and she ends up marrying into the minor aristocracy. So it's Victorian London. Of course, I think whatever you write, there is something of you in there.
So do you find that the discipline of writing fiction is different to that of writing poetry?
Very different. Very different.
It's sort of easier to force yourself to do it and not just produce contrived rubbish.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, because I think that writing fiction responds very well to discipline. You know, I kind of quite like a routine because I'm not working at the moment for health reasons. So it's quite good for me to have a routine of some sort. And with fiction, you go to your desk, you know, and I say, I want to get started by 10 o'clock. And I'm going to sit there for a certain amount of time. Some days nothing will happen, but mostly the act of doing it, the simple act of writing will produce something. Whereas poetry really doesn't like that, in my experience. Of course, when you're writing a novel, when I'm writing a novel, I'm virtually living with that novel in my head. I go to sleep thinking about it. I wake up thinking.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I read somewhere that Hemingway talking about writing. He said he always stopped at a point where he knew exactly what he was going to do next. And if he didn't, then he would have trouble getting going again.
That's actually very good advice as well, because it, at least you've got somewhere to pick up from. Because there's always that, you know, no matter how well it's going, there's always a bit of dread as the moment to, you know, whether you're working on the screen or by hand or whatever, the moment of starting has a certain amount of dread attached to it. So if, especially if you're sort of halfway through a sentence, then you've got somewhere to start with immediately.
Yeah, yeah, he just said he knew exactly what the first sentence he would write the next day would be, and then he could switch off for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
Listen to music and get drunk or whatever he did, you know.
He did. He used to write in the morning and then go and have a plate of oysters somewhere. And some, this is when he was in Paris. And, yeah, drink through the afternoon, I think.
Yeah, I read that he also he did all his writing standing up.
He did, yes.
I don't know why.
No, actually, I don't know why either.
I've never done that, have you?
No, I like sitting down, personally.
Definitely, yeah.
It's one of the advantages of being a writer is you get to sit down a lot.
That's right, yeah.
That was Lorna Thorpe in conversation with Jeff Hattersley. You can find out more about Lorna on her website at lornathorpe.com. And that concludes episode 159, which was recorded by Jeff Hattersley and produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 160, translators Sarah Artizzoni and Ewan Cameron speak with fellow translator Nick Kaister about the pleasures and challenges of rendering another writer's work into a new language and what liberties a translator should and shouldn't take. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.